The Capital Ideas podcast now has a new monthly edition hosted by Capital Group CEO Mike Gitlin. Investment professionals reveal their best mentors, how they find their next great idea, and a few funny stories. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. American Funds Distributors, Inc.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Donald Trump called off a military strike on Iran in mid-mission Thursday night because it would have killed too many Americans, he said. What are the implications of this decision for his Iran policy and American interests around the world? Plus, more good news from the U.S. Supreme Court. Welcome. I'm Paul Gigot with my colleagues here, Daniel Henniger. Hey, Dan.
Good to be with you.
And Kyle Peterson. Hello, Kyle.
Hello, hello.
All right. Let's talk about Iran. Major news and rather extraordinary, Dan. I'm trying to think. Been trying to think all day about when an American president stopped a military mission that he had signed off on and approved in mid-mission. And I have to say, I can't recall one. The president saying he did it because he had been told that once the planes were in the air, the ships were sailing, that there would be 150 Iranian casualties or so, and he thought that was disproportionate to the Iranian provocation of shooting down a $125 million American drone that was operating over international shipping lanes in the Gulf region. And the Iranians, of course, said it's in Iranian territory, but Germany has supported the U.S. Position on the fact that it was over international waters. What does this signal to you about Donald Trump's Iranian policy or in his foreign policy more broadly?
Well, let's talk about the Iranian policy first. The president's Iran policy was to terminate the Iran nuclear deal that Barack Obama and John Kerry had negotiated with the Iranian government. And Mr. Trump has always criticized that deal, and one of his earliest acts was to terminate our participation in it, arguing that Iran would never, in his word, in fact, he repeated it again today when making the announcement on the pullback of the military strike, Iran will never get a nuclear weapon. That has been the policy. That has been their goal. The U.S. government has imposed sanctions on Iran to that end, had to squeeze the Iranian economy. And I think, Paul, it was probably really quite predictable that we were going to arrive at this point, that we've known for months that the Iranian government was really quite pressed by these sanctions, and the feeling was that at some point they would, mount some sort of counter strategy against it. And of course, the United States famously, about a month or so ago, moved a carrier into the Gulf, and because we had intelligence suggesting that the Iranians were imminently going to carry out a strike, possibly against U.S. forces somewhere in the Middle East. So I assume that the military it's their job to plan for a contingency like this. They must have known what military options were available to them should Iran strike. They struck. They have shot down a very large U.S. surveillance plane. The president was about to strike back and has pulled back. So in sum, Paul, I would say that his Iran policy is, if not dead in the water, it's very still in the water. I mean, at this point, what incentive do the Iranians have to negotiate with the United States, which at least at this point has shown it's not going to use the military option? If not, how does the president intend to achieve his goal of thwarting Iran from pursuing a nuclear weapon?
Yeah, I mean, President Trump is getting a lot of praise today, particularly from the left, for his restraint on this, which I don't quite understand. I mean, to Dan's point, you'd think that people in the Pentagon would have planned for this. When the American drone was shot down, they would have presented the president with a range of options, you know, ranging from increasing sanctions or hacking, cyber hacking, to maybe hitting some, you know, facilities with a very low or no casualties, to this 150 casualty option. It's inconceivable that the president would not have been briefed on that stuff before launching the strike. So he says that, you know, 10 minutes before the strike was going to happen, he pulled it back. And it's hard to make sense of that. I mean, did he not?
You don't take that at face value, that that's what the real reason was? I mean, because you're basically saying that this is the potential damage and casualties would have been laid out to the president in the decision-making process.
Well, I'm saying whatever his explanation just does not look for good for him, whatever the case may be. I mean, it seems he says 10 minutes before he got this number of 150 casualties, and he said, no, that's not proportionate. So by his own explanation, either he didn't get the information that he should have gotten up front before launching the strike in the first place, or he's being a little bit coy and deceptive, and there's another reason. Maybe he flinched, but it's hard for me to understand the praise for this move as showing restraint when the move, by his own explanation, doesn't really make any sense.
Well, I guess the optimistic case would be that by showing restraint now, he's shown he's signaling, okay, I'm willing to go there. I just was on the edge of having a military strike. And we've heard reports that the Iranians actually thought it was going to happen. But by showing restraint, he will demonstrate to the Europeans in particular, who have not wanted to join him in pressuring Iran to revise the Iranian nuclear deal that Barack Obama struck in 2015. Maybe now the Europeans will come to his side, rally to Trump, and press the Iranians to come to the table. That's the optimistic case. I mean, the argument against that, Dan, is that the Iranians have shown no inclination at all to want to renegotiate the deal as long as the sanctions, tough sanctions, are on. And that includes, of course, banning Iranian oil sales, which has really squeezed the regime's finances, and sanctioning the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, the expeditionary force of the Iranian regime.
Yeah, that's right. It's a little difficult to predict. Emmanuel Macron said today that the way forward lay through negotiations. Angela Merkel in Germany also said it's a political solution is obviously what should be pursued now. Macron said that this should be a subject to be put on the table at the G20 meeting in Japan next week. So it looks as though what the world wants to do is stand back and talk. I'm a little leery about that one myself, Paul. The Iranians have been through this exercise once before. It was the negotiation of the deal itself with Barack Obama and John Kerry. And they proved themselves pretty good at brinksmanship, since that deal was negotiated towards the end of the Obama presidency, and Obama and Kerry were under a lot of pressure. And you could argue now that this kind of reverses the pressure of the moment and puts it back on President Trump, who's pulled back from this military option, it does leave open the question of whether the military option has been taken off the table. He would never say that. The U.S. would never say that. But they have seemed to have established a criterion, which is that it would be used if the Iranians killed an American, a member of our forces, or you know, anywhere in the U.S. or in Europe. The Europeans were upset with the Iranians in the past year because they did assassinate Iranian dissidents on their soil in Europe. But it looks to me as though the momentum is kind of reversed here, and that the pressure is off the Iranians to come to the table, and the pressure is on the president to find his way to some sort of deal with the Iranians.
We are talking about the Donald Trump in Iran, and you're listening to Potomac Watch from the Wall Street Journal.
This episode is brought to you by Vanta. Managing the requirements for modern security programs is increasingly challenging. Vanta's trust management platform helps you quickly assess risk, streamline security reviews, and automate compliance for SOC 2, ISO 27001, and more. Plus, save time by completing security questionnaires with Vanta AI. Learn how by watching Vanta's on-demand demo at vanta.com/WSJ. That's VANTA.com/WSJ.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. I'm Paul Gigot with Dan Henninger and Kyle Peterson here on Potomac Watch. And the thing that I think I would raise a question about in regard to the president's stand down militarily is the message of deterrence and what message that sends. Obviously, the Iranians have been escalating. They, since the imposition of the oil sanctions, they have done damage to oil terminals in the Middle East. That didn't get a response. They have sent – the Houthis have been sending missiles into Saudi Arabia. That hasn't been enough for a military response. Then they mined oil tankers, and that wasn't enough. Then they shot down this American drone, which the president first said it's – Iran is making – has made a big mistake. Then he said, well – could have been some rogue general or something. But that now has not gotten an American response. If it does not yield the negotiations that you have talked about, Dan, and Iran decides to escalate further, then the president may be forced – his hand may be forced later on to take even more aggressive military action. And I guess my point of when he says, I didn't want to take 150 Iranian lives, which he could have potentially done, has he put more American lives on the line in the future? And what happens if there is some – if some Iranian proxy kills Americans? You know that Donald Trump is going to be blamed because he reduced the credibility of America's deterrent.
Right. And I mean, I guess that's what I was trying to suggest by bringing up this range of options. To me, if what he wanted was a proportionate response to the downing of an unmanned drone, the Pentagon surely could have come up with one, you know, whether it was hitting, you know, airfield somewhere or, you know, some sort of military facility that wouldn't be manned in the middle of the night. Surely there's something that they could have done that would have been a proportional response other than run this whole thing all the way up the flagpole, get everything locked and loaded, as the president said, and then say, ooh, no, we were just, you know, it's too much. You know, maybe we'll think about doing something later. I mean, that is a much worse deterrent, I think, than doing a proportional response in the first place. That's why I find this so puzzling.
Well, you also – I think there's the possibility that, as I said, momentum moving against the president, that – to go back to the beginning, the Iran policy was to pull out of the Iran deal and force Iran back to the table. Now, if you're sitting in the capitals of Paris, Germany, and Beijing and the rest of it, it looks as though there wasn't ultimately a thought-out game plan in the White House for how to get to that goal. And if it could be pushed off whatever strategy it was on, which was to squeeze Iran economically – by events like this, as you suggested, Paul, by the mining of these tankers in the Gulf and now the shooting down of this drone, if the U.S. can be pushed off a strategy by that, then maybe a lot of people are going to start thinking the status quo ante was better than this, which is to say the original Iran deal.
Yeah, the consequence – I mean, there's a – I think the president is in some ways caught here between his goals – the goals of his policy, which is to deny Iran a nuclear weapon and to apply maximum pressure to do that through sanctions and economic pressure, which has been working. That has been working, which is why the mullahs are now acting out in back. But he's caught between those goals and the means he's actually being willing to use to achieve them. And he is – he just doesn't want to take military action. I think that's now plain. I think it's obvious that he doesn't want to do that. And look, you can argue that there's a good reason not to do it. But if you're and if that's the case, if you're Rand Paul, for example, who is a close advisor to this president, talks to him all the time, then look, maybe you have to change the policy, because if you don't, maybe you don't even have to. Maybe you have to go back to the Iran deal, or just concede that Iran is going to get a nuclear weapon eventually.
Yeah, well, that's a pretty dire consequence. I mean, the Israelis would not be too happy with that. And that was one of the valid reasons for pulling out of the deal itself, which is that there was a breakout year of, what was it, 2025, when
many of the terms of the Iran nuclear deal do expire in 2025.
Yeah.
Not all of them, but many of them.
And there was no real limit on the Iranians' missile development program, and the inspection regime really was not airtight. I mean, the president was justified in pulling out of that nuclear deal. But now the question is whether he had a end plan to achieve it.
Right. And this Iranian aggression on its own might have made European allies in particular more open to cooperating with the sanctions regime. I mean, some of them had been trying to figure out workarounds to kind of do some business with Iran. And, you know, this mining of commercial vessels and the shooting down of American drone maybe would have brought them more over to the United States side to, you know, tighten the sanctions a little bit. But again, now we have this instance of confusing policy that seems erratic. And what does Donald Trump even want from his Iran policy? It's just not even clear anymore.
Yeah, I think that that's a real danger here. And I guess the president would not like this analogy, but I think we have to put it on the table. Is this comparable in the magnitude to the Barack Obama walking away from his red line in Syria on the use of chemical weapons? We know what happened then. I mean, Vladimir Putin decided to jump into Syria. China expanded its presence in the South China Sea. Iran decided to become much more aggressive via proxies and spreading its Quds force around the Middle East. Once your adversaries make a judgment that your tough talk isn't credible, they will call your bluff.
Yeah, they will. And as well, you might cite the president's decision to pull all of U.S. troops out of northern Syria, causing Secretary of Defense Jim Mattis to resign. In the event, we have not pulled all the troops out. We just announced, I believe, last week that perhaps another 1,000 were going to go back there.
Not to Syria. That would be for the larger Middle East theater.
For the larger Middle East theater. So, you know, this president is capable of revisiting his decisions. It is entirely possible that within the next week, we're going to see something more forceful, maybe not military action, but it's hard to predict exactly where we're going with this.
Yeah, I think it depends on how the Iranians respond here, and we'll have to see. But I think there's the big question is, Kyle, you said the president's getting some praise at home, but the question is, how do our adversaries see it? Do they see this as a sign of indecision and weakness? That's the key question for me. All right, let's turn to the Supreme Court, a little more pleasant subject, often controversial, but here is the Supreme Court is going to the end of its term. We're getting some interesting decisions and encouraging ones if you happen to be a believer in the original Constitution, Kyle, and most recently now the decision on the Bladensburg Cross. That's the Bladensburg's Maryland Cross that was built in 1925 to celebrate World War I sacrifice of soldiers killed. And the ACLU and others sued to get it to have it removed as a violation of the establishment of the clause of the Constitution because it sits on public land. And the Supreme Court resoundingly said 7-2, no way the cross can stay.
To me, this is a sign that common sense can still prevail in these ideological times. I mean, the Establishment Clause says that the state cannot establish a religion. So if you're driving across the country and you – in 2019 and you hit Maryland and in the median, you see a large –
which is where it is, by the way. It's right, in a median.
You see a large stone cross with a bunch of male names on it. If your reaction is, wow, I must have entered a jurisdiction run by intolerant Christians, and this is their sign to me that I'm not welcome here, I think that you're not being common sense. You're not having a reasonable interpretation of what that kind of a symbol means in that context. One thing that was interesting about the decision is that it was a 7-2 decision, but although a large majority of the court came to the conclusion that the monument was fine, there was no broad agreement over the legal reasoning for it. So it was a 7-2 decision, and the court issued 7 different opinions. There was a majority opinion, there was a dissent, and there were 5 concurring opinions. So it shows, again, just that there are all sorts of different legal interpretations, ways of reading these laws, these statutes. We talk a lot about, there's a perception that there's red justices and blue justices in conflict, and it's just a lot more complicated than that.
But don't you give any – I mean, don't you think this is a big – not a victory, not just for common sense, which I take your point, but for religious liberty? And the reason I say that is because this took a big step back with 7 justices in my mind from the so-called Lemon Test, which the court had invoked in 1971. That made it easier to challenge these symbols and practices, even prayer in before a congressional session of a state legislature was challenged. Dan, this is a real step back towards what I would call the original understanding of the Establishment Clause, which will allow more tolerance and pluralism in religious practice without people, as Kyle says, getting all upset because they happen to see the Ten Commandments somewhere.
Well, yeah, and on that point, I would recommend to our listeners, if this weekend you want to do something really, really enjoyable, run down Justice Neil Gorsuch's concurring opinion in this case. It is a wonderful read. He's a beautiful writer. But Justice Gorsuch ran right at the Lemon Test, the idea that you had to figure out whether there's any entanglement of religion in something like this. But more than that, and even more seriously, he wrote at length about something called the Offended Observer Test, going to the idea that you're driving down the road, as Kyle was describing it. You see this big cross and you decide it offends my religion or my sense of not having religion in the public square, and lo and behold, you end up before the Supreme Court.
You sue. And you have standing to sue.
And Justice Gorsuch just tears this idea limb from limb, but he raises the issue of whether being offended by something is sufficient to have standing in cases like this. Now, against that, Justice Ginsburg, joined by Justice Sotomayor, Justice Ginsburg read her dissent out loud and calling the something like this cross exclusionary. And you know, Paul, the idea of being offended by events, by speech, by structures like this, what could be more common in our time? People are offended by Civil War monuments. People are offended by speech, which they interpret as being racist or gender associated. There are a lot of reasons and a lot of people getting into trouble today at universities and corporations because they do something that offends. And I think Justice Gorsuch is running straight at that idea.
The particular language Gorsuch used, which comes out of Supreme Court opinions, is that to have the legal standing to sue, you have to claim a concrete and particularized injury. That means you actually have to have some harm done to you. And he's basically saying that being emotionally offended, essentially, is not a particularized injury. And he, as he put it, in a large and diverse democracy, a diverse country, offense can be easily found. every 2 minutes somewhere.
As it is now.
and then he adds, there's a line that I thought was funny. He says, most every government action probably offends somebody. And I thought about the breadth of what government does these days and kind of had a chuckle to myself at that.
Well, I think the interesting thing here to me more broadly is this court is moving, I think, to a more original understanding of the First Amendment and the Establishment Clause. And they even managed to drag Stephen Breyer and Elena Kagan a good portion of the way, not totally, and their concurrence makes some important distinctions with the majority opinion by Samuel Alito. And it's certainly they're not going as far as Gorsuch. But I think you can see this court moving in that direction. And I think it's very, very healthy for American pluralism because you're not going to get all these people suing at the drop of a hat and claiming offense so easily. Now, the bigger fight to come is the free exercise of religion, and that gets going to get into the fight over are you obliged to bake a cake for a gay marriage ceremony, for example. Those are the fights to come. But this court is, I think, making real progress on the First Amendment, and I think it's very encouraging for American pluralism.
Yeah, and again, to mention Justice Gorsuch and indeed Justice Kavanaugh, the two Trump appointees, a generalized point that they keep raising is one we've talked about for a long time, is that if you have particular grievances of one sort or another, should your recourse be to run to the courts all the time, or should some of these matters be subjected to the legislative process? Work out your problems in the political process legislatively. And I think, Justice Gorsuch in particular has been trying to push the idea that that especially liberals today should not be resorting to either using administrative bureaucracies or indeed the courts to achieve goals and ends that they cannot get through, say, the Congress of the United States.
Still some opinions left to go in the next week from the Supreme Court, including big ones, Kyle, on the census and on partisan gerrymandering.
Right, and that may be why we're getting some of these strange 7-2 opinions with seven different breakdowns this week, because the big 5-4s are probably coming next week.
Is that what you would predict?
That's what I would predict, yes.
Yeah, okay, all right. Well, we'll watch that and be here to talk about it next week. Thank you all for listening, and we'll be back next week with another edition of Potomac Watch.
This episode is brought to you by Charles Schwab. Decisions made in Washington can affect your portfolio every day. But what policy changes should investors be watching? Washington Wise is an original podcast for investors from Charles Schwab that unpacks the stories making news in Washington and how they may affect your finances and portfolio. Listen at schwab.com/washingtonwise.